Hey everyone, this is Chris Hall and you're listening to the Downtime Podcast, where we delve deep into the gravity-based side of mountain biking. This week, the podcast is supported by Layer and Nukeproof. Layer now sell everything from helmets and braces through protection and apparel to riding shoes. I've been riding in some of their kit over the last few weeks and I've been really impressed. In previous episodes, I've mentioned the Airflex Pro knee guards, which are definitely the most comfortable knee pad I've ever ridden in, and also have talked about their DBX 4.0 shorts, which are a tough but comfortable and quiet riding short. In addition to that, I've been using their 3.0 shoes. Now, Layer have put a massive effort into their entry into the riding shoe market, and it really shows. The shoes are well thought out, they were comfortable from the get-go, and I have to admit, I was a bit sceptical over the grip that they provide, as the sole feels pretty tough. But when you ride in, the combination of the rubber compound that they've used together with the sole pattern, it works really, really well. After a few weeks of riding, there's no evidence of the pedal pins eating into the sole pattern, so I'm suspecting that they're going to be pretty durable too. They've done a really good job of shrugging off some of the July showers that we've had lately as well, leaving my feet dry at the end of the ride. So far, I'm pretty impressed. You can check out everything that Layat has to offer over at layat.com. That's L-E-A-T-T.com. If you want to be in with a chance of winning a pair of their new Aaron Chase signature shoes, then all you need to do is to head to layat.com/AC shoe and fill in your email address there. You've got until the end of July to get that done to be in with a chance to win. All the links you need are in the show notes for this episode over on downtimepodcast.com. Nukeproof are well known for their bikes, but alongside that, they also have a massive range of other components too. I've got their bars, stem, pedals, headset and bottom bracket on my new bike, and it's all really good quality stuff. As far as flat pedals go, no one knows them better than Sam Hill himself, and I've been using the latest iteration of his signature pedal developed by Sam and his mechanic JC. They're grippy, tough, well sealed, and they're now even lighter, with some excess material removed to give you more clearance to rocks and other trail obstacles. If you're looking for some great kit to finish your bike, then Nukeproof would be well worth a look. You can check out everything they have to offer over at nukeproof.com. And for you Downtime listeners, Nukeproof are giving away a set of their new Horizon wheels worth £400 in whatever size you need for your bike. To be in with a chance of winning, just head over to downtimepodcast.com/nukeproof and answer the ridiculously easy question before the end of July. If you didn't already know, then my web store is back open. It's a brand new store with a brand new range of t-shirts. They're all made from a super soft 100% organic cotton with a really great fit, and they're made using renewable energy too. And they're cheaper than they were before. Can't say better than that. So if you want to look great and help the podcast at the same time, then you can head to downtimepodcast.com/shop now and check them out. If you're not yet subscribed to the podcast, then you really should. That way you'll never miss an episode. It's free and it's super simple to do. Just head to downtimepodcast.com/subscribe and click the button for whichever platform is best for you. While you're on that page, you should also join our newsletter and you'll get a weekly email from me with some interesting stuff from the world of mountain biking. Please also give us a follow on Instagram or Facebook, where we're at Downtime Podcast. And if you've got a couple of minutes, then leaving us a review wherever you listen to the show really helps me out. All right, this week's episode is a little different and it's also super important. Litter on our trails and especially plastic pollution is a problem, not just because it looks a mess, but it's environmentally damaging too. Up until now, it's purely come down to relying on us being good citizens and not leaving our mark on the environments that we ride in that way. However, this alone is sadly not enough to keep our trails free of plastic pollution. Enter Dom Ferris and Trash Free Trails. Dom is a long-time mountain biker who has a passion for clearing up our outdoor spaces, and after spending many years helping Surfers Against Sewage improve our beaches and oceans, he's now turning his attention full-time to our trails. Today, Trash Free Trails are launching their State of the Trails report. I wanted you to know more about what Trash Free Trails are doing, and hopefully you'll want to get involved in some way. I sat down with Dom for a chat to find out more about what led him to do what he's doing now, what Trash Free Trails is, and how we can all help. So, without further ado, here's Dom Ferris. Dom Ferris, welcome to the Downtime Podcast. How's things with you?
Oh, hi, Chris. Yeah, good. Yeah, it's a bit windy and wild out in front of my window here down in Cornwall, but yeah, it's good. Looking forward to getting on the bike this weekend.
Nice one. You're right on the coast there, yeah?
Yeah, like I'm just... about 500 meters as the crow flies from St. Agnes, and I've got very, very lucky. It's not my house. I'm a lodger in a ramshackle house, but I've got a £100 house with £1 million view of the coast of the ocean. Yeah,
very nice.
Hopefully, Sounds Alex, good. The owner's not watching. listening.
Good stuff. Well, let's wind the clock back then a little bit and start off by telling us a little bit about growing up and your childhood and how bikes became part of your life.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was born in Birmingham, so I had 3 or 4 years there that I can vaguely remember. But then my mum mainly, actually, it turns out, dad preferred the pub, but mum wanted, they were into The Good Life, the film, the programme The Good Life. And we moved to Wales and bought this, again, ramshackle seems to have a bit of a theme, but a ramshackle kind of cottage on the side of the hill just over the border near Welshpool. And when I look back over my life, I realised that being there and in those woods and kind of on those beautiful trails down the side of this old hill called Mullygulver, that was definitely where I started to connect with the outdoors and you know, very naturally. And apparently around the same time, mum noticed that I was a bit of a weirdo about people littering. So really early on, it seems, 7 was the first time she spotted it.
Wow.
But yeah, nothing else. There's no other kind of, you know, I wasn't particularly, it was always just littering, and especially if it was in or around green spaces. Yeah, and then we moved to a place called a beautiful village called Maevod that's surrounded by 4 like made to measure mountain bike hills. And in like 1990, we bought these, I don't know if you remember, the Universal bikes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I got a Universal bike and I swear I was like 10 and 11 and I swear it was, oh no, we had Rally Mustang, but we were just doing jumps on the Rally Mustangs and Mavericks. So we, it was the Universal and I swear it was an 18-inch bike and I was 11 years old. And we used to just go and camp on, it was called Wilkins Hill. And we still ride there now. It's still got beautiful trails on. And we'd go and camp at Wilkins Hill and we'd push our bikes up and then we'd roll our bikes back down again. And before we knew it, we were rolling them. Oh, could we roll it down there? Could we roll it down there? And, and then one of our mates, Mike Davis, got the seat of his Carrera stuck up his bum and he never rode again. Honestly, I can still remember the howl. For me and 2 others in the group, it was just the start of a, you know, an absolute obsession, you know, and that's just become, you know, the most important thing in my life, really, cycling, and it's built community and keeps me fit and healthy and happy and is my therapy now, you know, as well, and has hopefully started to become my job. And that's the genesis of my love of mountain biking.
Amazing. You had a Proflex 550 at some point as well. It was a bit of a classic.
Oh yeah. Well, so, you know, then obviously, you know, back in the day, you're a young lad. I played football and rugby and my dad was very sporty. So obviously you go into competing. And I was really lucky that he was one of the best riders in the country at the time. He was 2 years older than me, a chap called Crispin Coxon. He, I don't know if you remember him at all, but he raced on the Mella team with Andrew Titley and a couple of other guys I can't remember. And I was 2 years younger, so I was just under that age group to start with. But I used to go to races with his mum, used to take me to races. And the first race I did, I borrowed his 18-inch Cannondale and I won that. It was up in Llanfair PH, proper North Wales. And there was a guy there who I've become friends with again recently, who you might remember again, a chap called Will Cogger. And he won like the youth trials champs and stuff. And he was winning all the youth races then. And he was, I think, kind of supported and then up to me and my dad, like clearly rugby players, not mountain bikers. And suddenly he was like, oh, who's this guy? Like, and I was like, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm just chasing you. Like I chase a ball, you know, and, and that progressed, was it? So I was 11 then and I raced till I was 14, 15. And it's funny, everyone's, you know, like in football, everyone says, I had trials once. I had a scout come and watch me. It's a little bit like mountain biking because I feel embarrassed, but I did get to the stage where I was top. I was consistently in the top 5 in the BMBF rounds and the under 16s. And I was 14 when I was racing my best. So I came 3rd in Hampstead, which is probably my favorite race. The, you know, when I think I was 13 or 14 and we were doing the same distance as the elites, 20 mile loop. I did that on a fully rigid rocky ridge, Marin Rocky Ridge. But my first love, bike wise, was the ProFlex 550 that after my dad didn't really think too seriously about mountain biking to start with, but then he came and saw me ride the cycling leg of a mini triathlon, and I kind of lapped everyone, and he was like, right, okay, he might be all right at this. And and before I knew it, my granddad, who believed in giving me his inheritance while he was alive, gave me £450 in cash, came down to it for breakfast. It's like, whoa. And yeah, I know, from that age, it's like, and we weren't well off either. It was just that he wanted to enjoy, see me enjoying it. And went to Mellor's, which is where Trailhead is now. And I walked in,
yeah,
and my eyes just, because I wanted a GT Karakoram, the red and blue one. That's what that was, 450. Yeah. Could afford that. And my dad's terrible, hence why he ended up, yeah. But we walked in and we saw the ProFlex 550, and it was just no chance that I was having anything else. And I think it was actually, it was £550, I think. You know, it was one of those, well, can't afford not to, you know.
Amazing.
Girvin Flex stem, elastomer front and rear, yeah.
Yeah, must be a pretty interesting ride compared to today's modern bikes. But yeah, the idea of the stem flexing up and down.
Yeah, weird, then, yeah.
I remember wanting one. I never had one, but must have felt weird.
Yeah, we trimmed the bars down because it was like Herbold thin bars, you know, and purple USE seat post. And I remember one day we raced Eastridge. It was so muddy that it was completely full of mud. And we worked out that it weighed like at least as much as I did, maybe more, because I was really skinny. I loved it, you know, and my dad loved it as well because he was very sociable. So he would, you know, wander around chewing everyone's ears off, you know, like embarrassing me in front of Titley, you know, because he was obviously the super cool guy at the time. And yeah, that was it. And then kind of sadly, really, like family life started to get a bit tricky financially. I don't know if you remember the late 80s and 90s. And family life started to break down a bit. And I found drink. And I look back and I realized it was kind of like, you know, as we maybe get into the, you know, the Oregon tour is that I have depression and anxiety, you know, and it peaks and troughs, but I'd classify it as mild, especially compared to some of the people who I've connected with over the recent years. But I think around that time, a few things happened, and having a gift for endurance sports, I turned my gift towards endurance drinking and partying. And I can remember so clearly, I went from being like, I realized that a lot of my skill was fitness. So football, I was playing amongst guys who went on to play for, you know, well, like some, you know, professional teams. And as soon as I wasn't as fit as I was, I realized that I wasn't actually that skillful. Yeah. And then it just got less fun. And me and dad argued, and I kind of drifted. I kept riding bikes, but, you know, racing suddenly became hard, and I suddenly wasn't as good as I was. And it angered my dad, and it just all soured. So a really, really sad thing really is, especially because I'm massively back into it now. I look back and I'm like, what if, you know? And I know you're meant to not have any regrets, but I find it difficult not to have regrets around that.
That's fair enough.
Yeah,
good to be honest about it.
Yeah, I think so. Then yeah, you just fast forward to, but I stayed super involved with the outdoors, you know. So I became an outdoor instructor. But must admit, for a long time, I did all the sports. I climbed a mountain bike still. I started to surf and run and play football. But it always took a bit of a backseat to how much fun partying was. I think I also realized during that period that it wasn't making me feel very good about myself. So, yeah, I'm not sure where we are in the conversation now. Maybe I'll pause a little bit, pause for breath. I feel like I'm an oversharer, as you might be classified.
I'm all good with that. Yeah, no, that's cool. And so you've got this, like you say, this natural instinct to protect the environment and our green spaces from a very young age. And is that kind of what led you to studying what you did at university?
Yeah, it's good that you've checked me. I think go back a few steps as well, really, in that when I was about 11 years old, I went to an outdoor, I was pretty bad, I was pretty naughty in school as well, so I wasn't very good with authority and I wanted to be outside all the time. And there was a massive link to how good the weather was compared to how poor my behavior in classrooms was. And at about 11 years old, I basically completely committed. I want to be an outdoor pursuits instructor. I went to Stay Little. There we go. Stay Little. And Mountain Bike Wales have just bought Stay Little, actually. Okay. Phil Stasiou and Polly Clark. I'm not sure if they're there. So that's cool to see them buy that. So I went there and I was like, right, I want to be an outdoor instructor. So it was all, I became that in 16. But I very quickly realized when I was doing that, that I was quite good. And my mum ran a Montessori nursery and she's like a positive Pied Piper with kids. And I think some of that has come off on, has rubbed off on me. And I noticed that I really enjoyed creating that little spark of connection in kids, you know, especially kids that maybe weren't finding it so easy in the normal academic routes, you know, where you could actually use the outdoors to help them realize that there were other things they could do and there are other ways they could succeed and feel a sense of achievement. So I will say that, like, I don't think I would be what you classify as a classic environmentalist, because I feel extremely contradictory and hypocritical being classed as an environmentalist, because I fly, you know, I haven't flown for a while, but I flew all over the world in 2018. You know, I'm above average on my single use plastic use. Like, you know, I haven't used a plastic drinks bottle for 5, 6, 7 years. And then, you know, I try hard, but I could try harder and I still eat packs of crisps, you know? And, so I feel contradicted there, but I don't feel contradicted when I talk about not harming the environment you use to enjoy. So in other words, and I feel quite good and I can actually leave it better than I went there. And I also know that I'm good at showing that to people and letting them feel how that can enhance their experience in the outdoors. So yeah, I suppose I want to be clear, really, and that's what Trash for Charles is. We want to be clear that there's no guilt or shame involved or perfection. It's just one step at a time. Try your best and remember why you're doing it. So I ended up, I left school early, and I was okay. You know, I got good marks. Like, the headmaster was not happy because he thought I was going to fail everything. I don't know, mate. I don't know how I did it either. But, and then I got to about, I went outdoor pursuits and I went to spend some time in America where I learned my, at summer camp, where I kind of, that was where my ethos around working with people, really, with building community stems from. Everything there was focused on, so in Britain in the 90s, outdoor pursuits was focused on the abseil. So in other words, kids did nothing. You didn't really engage with them properly until that 30 seconds of abject terror when you just threw them off a cliff. And then they go back to sitting down waiting in the rain. Whereas in America, it was all about the community and spending time together. And you would use the activities, the vehicles to enhance those experiences, enhance that connection. And I just loved it. So again, took that on, and that's a really firm part of Trash Free Trails. But yeah, you know, what happened, then I started working with kids with behavioural problems and around kind of like 2004-05, it was the time, really, I'd been working in that for a while, it was time to become a manager. And I just didn't want to. And I was burning out a bit because it's extraordinarily hard work. If you're not like a pure saint, and I consider some people who work with kids to be absolutely saints. It's incredible. It chips away at you. It just does, because these youngsters are so damaged and that it's inevitable that some of that kind of like osmosis, you know, comes across to you via osmosis. And I wasn't coping very well personally. I was partying too much, drinking too much. And I realized that if I didn't do something then, I might disappear, you know, I might lose myself, if you know what I mean. I might lose myself from a perspective of achieving something in my life to be proud of. So I without really thinking about it much, because I wanted to learn to surf, I signed up to surf science and technology degree in Newquay. And so I could only afford to insure and buy a metro. So I drove to Cornwall. I drove to Cornwall in 2005 with everything I owned, including a surfboard that I wasn't good enough to surf on top. In my white metro. And drove to Cornwall in 2006 to start this degree. Yeah, which, it's like that horrible, that cliche, isn't it? I mean, there's no doubt that it completely changed my life, you know, because I'm talking to you, you know, Dom Ferris of 2004. You would not be talking to Dom Ferris in 2004 now. You'd be going, well, it's a shame, you know.
Fair play.
So. And
surfing became quite a big passion then at that point in your life, massive, I guess, once you ended up in the right place for it.
Yeah, it was a cool thing to mountain biking in Myvod village with my mate Craigie, who I've got to share this with because he's a mate, you know, he's not mountain biking anymore. We still talk a lot about those days. We're a year and a half into being serious mountain bikers and Point Break came out and the Chili Peppers were super popular. And Elwyn Roberts was, I don't remember Elwyn Roberts. He was, him and Andrew Titley were like Even Stevens, downhill, Beth Gellert years.
Okay.
And he used to wear this dude, such a dude, a leather jacket, crazy rocker leather jacket with Chili Peppers on the back. And I was like, whoa, my God. So for me, yeah, Blood Sugar Sex Magic, Point Break. And we'd sit and we'd repeat that thing. We'd want to be sitting there, man, in our tin can, in our tin coffins, and you know. And it's like I identify surfing as this escape from this little tiny village, you know. It's like if I could do that, and being a constant child, I still attached way too much importance to that when I was 27. And I just became completely obsessed with the ocean and with surfing for mountain biking's taken over as number one again. It was incredible. The good thing about surfing is it's easier to do with a hangover than mountain biking. When I lived in Newquay, everyone's listening knows all about Newquay. I don't need to explain that. You know, it was fun. Let's put it that way. And
it's a party town, isn't it?
Yeah, it was fun. And we worked there and I worked at an outdoor center. It was really, I suppose, so. The degree I always just saw as a vehicle because I still wasn't a person that's particularly proud of himself because I'm still telling stories like, you know, when I tell stories about drinking and things like that, I'm actually, there's a little bit of like, shut up, Dom, like you're kind of saying it like it's cool still. I still have that bad habit because I wasn't really happy and I was, you know, yeah, I wasn't proud of myself. And then I, finished the degree, did well. The last year was a bit too much because I had to do 4 years because I left school early. And the last year was a bit of a struggle. And then total fluke. This is like literal unicorn poo because at the time, the holy grail job of my degree was to get a job with Surface Against Sewage. You know, at the time there was only four of them worked there. So, you know, to get a job there and it's like job for life kind of thing, really, for someone who loves surfing and lives in Cornwall. Where you want it to be anyway. And a job popped up, Protect Our Waves campaign officer. And I was like, oh my God. Like literally at that age, I'm 29 years old, I think 29, 30. And that's the first job I'd ever applied for. So before that, I'd always just got jobs through who I knew. So, I mean, you know, and like go for an interview and get asked over a pint, that kind of thing. So I put so much care into this application, designed my own campaign. It was based around Apocalypse Now. So it was Apocalypse Now. Yeah. So it's like, you know, the kind of, I love the smell of napalm in the morning on the waves and things. Got the interview, felt good like in the interview and then got the call like a week or so later saying, look, Don, we really liked you, but Fred, you've come. I mean, it's that old classic one. You've come a close second. And I was like, oh, yeah. How many people come a close second? Yeah. So I was disappointed massively. And I think I gave up too early because I wasn't used to like how to apply for jobs. So I gave up too early and actually went home to Mid Wales So I just spent all this money, 5 years in Cornwall. I went back and I actually went backwards because I'd been in Shrewsbury for a while. I went all the way back into Mid Wales and rented a room from my younger friends. And I must admit, again, started to not do so well. Went back to work with Kids With Care. I actually started the process of joining the RAF because I was like, I just need to stabilize myself and, you know, get my life on a track I could imagine affording a house. I was not happy with that idea. I just thought, right. And then I got a phone call on like almost Christmas Eve, and it was Hugo, the chief executive from SAS. And I was like, "Wow, okay, what's this?" And he's like, "Says, would you still be interested in the job?" I was like, "You got no idea, my friend." And he said, "Sadly, it's not worked out with the person we took." And he explained that they didn't want to employ me. Well, no, actually, no, he didn't explain then. We explained over beers about 5 years later when I said, "Why didn't you?" And they basically said, "You were too much like us. We didn't need another one of us," we thought. And they employed this really talented woman with journalistic skills. And just sadly, it just didn't quite work out because back then it was extraordinarily intense at SAS. You know, we're talking like multiple round trips to Aberdeen in one go with a campaign action in the middle, you know, and then back to the office to write it all up. And it was full on, you know, and just doesn't suit everyone. We're not doing that anymore, but yeah, that was the time. And after a rocky 6 months where I still tried to behave a bit like something changed in me, like that's not changed back. And I was like, saved my life. I think really saved my life for me, if you know what I mean, in that I'm still drinking, you know, and coming into work with a hangover and things like that. And I just suddenly didn't want to anymore. Suddenly work was more important to me. And it was what I always wanted from when I was 16, 17. I was like, I want to be like that guy, that woman on TV, you know, like Lois Lane, do you know, where they're just like, it's everything. They love it so much. It's part of them. And I'd given up on that. And suddenly it became like that. And it was such a beautiful feeling. And people, I didn't want to go home as much, actually. I didn't go home for a long time back then because people knew me as Dom Surfers Against Sewage. And I was, you know, they were impressed by Dom Surfers Against Sewage, you know, and I really liked that. And it made me very proud, you know, and I found something else. I found my niche in Surfers Against Sewage too. I, you know, used all my old skills and they were starting to go, oh God, okay, there's something in this. Because at the time, beach cleans weren't anything really. No, they weren't really a thing. You know, you go to a beach and someone will go, what are you doing now? It's clean. What's a beach clean? Plastic pollution. What, you know, and I turned, you know, it's always embarrassing to say, but you know, Hugo credits me. So, you know, I changed the model of a beach clean from a litter pick to a community event. And you can see the DNA of that moment in February, 2018 at Port Thowan Beach, where I argued with my then boss to say, no, I want everyone to stay. And we're going to talk to everyone as a group rather than sending them off individually. And you can see that in how beach cleans have grown. I don't know. I know what you're in, but that is, you know, there's nothing that has changed my life more than getting in that car and leaving Shrewsbury, where I was definitely on a hiding to nothing, you know. And to talking to you, you know, to gaining the confidence to do things, to follow what, you know, follow my kind of compulsion, you know, the kind of positive compulsion as opposed to the negative compulsions.
So you were at Surfers Against Sewage for a good chunk of time, kind of, I guess building communities around the projects and around their aims. What point did you start to think about the non-sea related environment and start thinking about trash-free trails?
So I started to get back into mountain biking quite early, actually, at Surfers Against Sewage, you know, properly. Like I'd got a proper bike again, and because again I started to party less and I felt fitter and stronger, and I wanted to get fitter and stronger. And around 2013, I remember you know, the beach leans and the education. And essentially what we, where I talk about it is like this bloom of marine conservation awareness and action was starting, you know, you could sense it. You could sense like the, everyone's interest was turning towards it. You know, every school wanted you to come and do a talk about it. And, you know, and it was, you know, you go to a festival and festivals wanted to come and have a big tent there. It was like, this is incredible. And then started to ride with my friends back up in Mid Wales. And, you know, you'd be sitting there, or even, well, there was a watershed moment, you know, we'd be sitting there on top of a trail, or, you know, there'd be a Lucozade bottle or a pile of crisp packets or something. And you just like, I just started to think the silence, firstly, I'm upset about this, and the silence around trail litter and our environmental responsibility, you know, at that kind of grassroots level to our trails and wild places, the silence is deafening in comparison to the marine conservation world. You know, there was just nothing going on. No conversations. I couldn't find them anywhere because I started to research them and I couldn't find anything. I couldn't find any scientific papers on the impacts of plastic on terrestrial ecosystems. I couldn't find any organizations. I was shocked, you know, I was like, well, okay, right. And still really, I left it a while because I was like, well, you know, I still had imposter syndrome, which I still do. You know, I was like, it's not really, I couldn't do it. I'm just a minion, you know, I've got a boss and I need to follow a boss. And I kept going. I thought, well, wait there. I think I got a promotion actually to project manager at Surfers Against Sewage. And I think that changed my view of myself as well. I'd gone from officer to manager, you know, and it's like, wow, I never thought, honestly, you know, it's impossible to overstate really how I just thought I wasn't, you know, going to be anything, you know? So it's, even now it's like, you get a bit, so nothing, it might seem strange to some people, but that change, they're being called a project manager, it changed, you know, just made me feel so proud of myself, you know, and I started to think, well, maybe I am qualified to start a grassroots movement about protecting the places they love, because I'm kind of doing that like already. Luckily for me, a wonderful girlfriend at the time, who's a designer, and we started like talking about how it would look and feel, and we did a few early logos that we didn't get used initially. But I got myself a bit bogged down for 2 years because I was trying to create Surfers Against Sewage as Trashery Trail, if that makes sense. I was trying to create an organization. Yeah. And I was like, oh no, I need a website and I need like policies and I need campaign strategies and all that kind of stuff. And I need a scientific report. And I just totally got bogged down. And then other stuff happened, like sadly, yes, my father passed away, and it just kind of all took a bit of a back burner. And then Keep Britain Tidy in like late, mid 2016 posted something with Steve Peat. It's just like one post. And I suddenly had this like shock. I was like, right, if you don't do something now, because the noise was building, you know, if you don't do something now, I learned this at Surfers Against Sewage, there's only one chance to be the organization who people say, have you heard about? If that makes sense. Because all that will happen is go, well, that's a nice idea. Have you heard about Trashy Trails? You know, and I didn't want that happening because we had it at Surfers Against Sewage. They'd be like, oh, that's nice, but have you heard about Marine Conservation Society? You know? And so I thought, right, it's now or never. And I just asked my friend, sadly I wasn't with my girlfriend, to design a logo, which is now our logo. She did it really quickly. It's like, yeah, that's perfect. And I started talking about it from a personal perspective on Instagram in January 2017. Yeah, that was it really, with not much more plan, you know, simple, trash-free trails, reduce litter on trails, ask people to help, you know, talk about why it's important to us. Just keep it simple and see what happens.
And that's where the ideas started to form. And
yeah,
over time, things have kind of, I guess, matured in your head and become what they are today. But on part of that route from then to today, you took some time out, didn't you? You were still at Surfers Against Sewage and you took a sabbatical.
Yeah.
Tell us a bit about kind of what drove that and what you did and how that helped drive Trash Free Trails forward as well.
Yeah, I suppose apologies to everyone listening, is that then we dip back into a bit of doom and gloom maybe. Is that so I think, you know, starting with my dad passing away in in late 2014, and I got ill as well. I had a it's hard to explain really, a cyst in my jaw that dissolved my jaw and into my so I had to have two operations, and there was a possibility that there was going to have to be a new normal, should we say, in terms of how my how my breathing and everything worked, and work got extraordinary. So Blue Planet 2 happened around this time as well. So suddenly we were already really busy, but we were still operating like a really, intense kind of clever cowboy operation. Sorry, SAS guys, if you're listening. Sorry, Hugo and Pete, especially. Pete would not have it. He wasn't a cowboy, but you know, we weren't like a smooth, efficient organization. And I had people I was managing, and I was trying to keep Trashy Trails going because people were getting more interested in it and saying, "Dom, have you got this? Have you got that? I want to do this. I want to do that." And yeah, in January 2018, I had a breakdown. Yeah, so found myself 5 nights in a row sat in this same cottage that looks so nice in the summer, but in the winter actually moves in the storms, staring at a fire that didn't work very well, and thinking some things that weren't great to be thinking about yourself. And it was a lot of, and my pride at my how good at my job I was had gone. It was to replace with constant guilt and shame because I wasn't doing it very well, and the wheels were falling off. And luckily for me, my best friend in the world, Pete, is the head of fundraising for Surfers Against Sewage, and I can tell him everything. And I told him, and he helped me talk to the guys at SA, the chief executive Hugo, and he was incredibly understanding and saw what was going on, and then they agreed to let me have a sabbatical, and that was in January. But my sabbatical didn't start till August, so during that time, we had a lot of work to do, including a royal event for Prince Charles that I project managed that broke me right at the end again, which affected the sabbatical. But yeah, so that was the reason for the sabbatical. Sorry, everyone, but again, I didn't want it to be just a holiday. Perhaps I should have just had a holiday, to be fair. Might have been wise. Coming back from that with having lost a stone and a half and exhausted was not ideal. When I'd seen my dad, he died of diabetes, and he died not very well and with, lost limbs. And I remember looking at him, sorry, it's so dark. But it's okay. Just to get it clear, really, for everyone listening, is that Trash Free Trails, our mission is twofold. And we call it twofold and inextricably linked. So it started off simple, as to reduce litter on our trails. That morphed into reduce it by 75% by 2025. But actually, the primary driver of myself and my partner, Ben, is to reconnect people with their wild selves and places through purposeful adventure. And the subtext to that is what we owe them for our, not just mental health, because I think we combine everything really, what we owe them everything really. I owe being able to get out in the hills and the oceans, everything. I owe the pride that I take from protecting these places, beach cleans. I owe it everything, literally, So that's why I find it very important personally, and hopefully some people find connection. It might turn some people off, to talk about them both hand in hand, because that's what we're about. That's what differentiates us from Surfers Against Sewage, for example. He died. He died young, and he died. And I stood looking at him, in his before he was put in the casket, and just had this promise to myself: like, you've told yourself for your whole life that you want to go for an adventure, that you want to see if you can be an adventurer, And I was like, well, you either do or you don't do it, And I think I was 38, 39 at the time. And so I was like, right, okay, now's the time. So I went on bikepacking.com, and initially I selected the GD, the Great Pacific Divide.
Yeah.
But I thought, this is my first big bikepacking trip. To be honest with you, first bike packing trip at all. I thought perhaps 2,500 miles and definite possibility of bears is not not the wisest first go. And I also didn't, I'm a mountain biker, like pure and simple, single track is heaven, you know? And I didn't think I'd really love, I think they had the bikepacking.com is amazing. It has the percentage single track on there. And I think GDPR is like less than 10, I think, or something. Whereas the Oregon Timber Trail, which I stumbled upon, is over 60% single track, yeah. 700 miles. Like, it just immediately, that's heaven. That's my adventure, you know? And then I got like randomly saw the Tibet trip. I thought, well, bugger it. Like, you know, I'm spending that much money on that. I'll just go Tibet as well. So I booked the Tibet trip. I managed to get a little discount there. And I thought, right, okay. How am I going to achieve this? And then I thought, well, the purpose behind this, and this is where the term purposeful adventure, which is going to be in the coming years, a key theme for Surfers Against, there we go, I still do it sometimes, for Trash Free Trails, is going to be purposeful adventure. And hopefully that kind of is easily understandable. People can imagine it, what we're trying to say there, but I'll talk about it a bit more later. And I thought, well, I'll demonstrate that. I'll make this a purposeful adventure. So the first thing is I wanted to raise money for a men's mental health charity. So I chose the Campaign Against Living Miserably, which I like the sound of, and they give me a nice bright red orange top. And I also thought, right, if you think Trash Free Trails is really something, go and test it. Go and try to tell people in Nepal about it. Go and try and have a conversation with a bike shop in Oregon about it. You know, go and see if the group that you ride with in Tibet are interested in what you've got to say and can see what it is. You know, so I thought, right, let's just go and test it. You know, I booked talks. I did talks in bike shops in Oregon. You know, and all way more stressful than I thought they were going to be, because all I had was an iPhone 6 that was running out of battery all the time. But yeah, and just went to Oregon, and just can't really even explain how hard or you know, Oregon, Tibet, and Nepal, really, I add them all in together. I ended up doing over 2,000 kilometers, and I think it worked out to over 200,000 foot of vertical ascent. Yeah, all on my amazing, like, thanks to the guys at Kotick, Rich Baber especially, they gave me the Kotick Solaris Max. Like, I didn't change anything the whole ride. Tires, that's it, changed tires. And I had one or two gear up. It's just nuts, that bike. I wore the jockey wheels down to nubs, actual nubs, it was great. But yeah, my belief in Trash Free Trails got stronger and stronger with like every pedal stroke. It sounds really cheesy. And I've started to refine myself because I was quite a forceful character when I was younger, especially. And sadly that often spilled into being a knobhead. But I started to feel my forceful character come back as well. And I started to feel my determination. And there was a couple of moments. There was a moment in the Oregon Timber Trail where I was on, just coming off Bunchgrass Ridge, which is the hardest section, one of the hardest sections. You spend 3 days on your own. I didn't see another human for 3 days. And I had a bad crash and fell off about 10 foot down and landed over a big tree that was on the floor. And I, looking back and having asked people, I think I cracked a rib. So the next, 2 weeks, the day was absolute agony. But I remember thinking, no point whatsoever, even like when crying and whining on the side of the trail, was there any thought in my brain about stopping? And I just, that was a moment for me. I was like, I thought transported straight back to being stood by my side of my dad, you know, and just went, I am an adventurer. I am, you know, I can do it, you know, like, because for me, that felt like the test. When it gets really shit, what's your instinct, you know?
Yeah.
Fight or flight. And I kept going and it was horrible because I had a really low tent. So getting out of my tent every day was like, and then rattling too. So even though I was like the hardtail steel, but still like, just brilliant. not long after that, I had to go through like about 10 miles of a volcanic lava field. That was fun. So that was one big moment, and it was just, yeah, I still have it now. I have like this little buzz of pride, you know, from myself. And then another one was Nepal. We were going up to, we did the Annapurna circuit, and there's a acclimatization day where you, ahead of going up to, I can't remember the name of the pass, but is up to a place called Tilicho Lake, and it's up to 5,100 meters. And, you know, you start at dawn, that kind of stuff. Only two of us did it because the other guys were feeling like they'd rather walk it. So we carried our bikes. And again, I was in like such pain, and I literally was one step, stop, you know, proper like, and again, it was amazing because it's like, this is like in the films. and I was stood there going, I'm not sure I can do this, but it wasn't ever going anywhere near I'm going to stop. It was just literally, I'm not sure physically I can do it. And again, I was like, that firstly, that's a cool feeling. To go, I might be at my physical limit, but I'm not thinking about stopping. I've got myself to my physical limit. And then I stopped on this set of switchbacks, just amazing, just like, and you can see for miles back. And suddenly over the Annapurna range, the sun just sparked. And like, I got a photo of it. Luckily, my friend, she's amazing. She took a photo at that moment, and she's subsequently drawn a picture. It's on Instagram. So she's actually painted the picture. And at the moment, I've got the bike on my shoulders. I'm thinking, I'm not sure if I can go on. And I felt this little pressure against my leg. And I look down, and this dog's come out of nowhere, and it's rested against my leg. And it's just wagging its tail. Cute. And I just like, I don't know, everything changed then. So suddenly started enjoying it. My friends who were walking were sitting 50 meters away eating early lunch or like breakfast or whatever. And I got to them, had that, and just loved the rest of it. You know, even the rest of it was harder. And we called that dog Switch for the switchbacks. Even though I didn't get the joke until I got to the top and got my breath back. So, oh yeah, I can see why you call it Switch now, because I wanted to call it like Lenny or something. I have rabbited again. Sorry, everyone. But those moments, and combined with the positive reaction, like everyone I've spoke to, except for a couple of quite territorial Canadians, who are like, "We don't have litter. We don't have litter." I'm like, "It's okay. That's a cool thing, you know." That's because I found the only time I've never been able to find plastic pollution ever in a beauty spot. Was on the top of a sawtooth mountain in Oregon. And again, they challenged me. They said, we don't have litter here. And I was like, there's always litter. And it was the first time in my life where I'd found, in my working life like this, I couldn't find any. And I was like, wow. And that moment actually redefined my definition of wilderness. Because if you think about now, the fact that plastic pollution is being found in like deep embedded in Arctic ice, it's been found recently by Swiss scientists on remote mountaintops that haven't ever been accessed by humans before they did the study. So plastic is now everywhere. You know, the stain of our overconsumption is everywhere. So really I've started to redefine true wilderness as being where humans have not harmed, if you know what I mean, which is getting less and less now, almost nowhere, you know, if it's at the Arctic Circle. So yeah. Those two themes, those two streams, those two trails, you know, finding my determination again and realizing that there was a global appetite amongst trail users, especially for the messages that I was trying to get out for Trash Free Trails. I came back with that. Yeah. Came back extremely skinned, totally exhausted with a knackered pair of hips. I weighed under 10 stone with a giant beard. But I came back thinking Trash Free Trails is something, and it can be something, and I want to make it something. So that was January 2019 when I got back.
Yeah, fair play. And what's happened since then? Because I think I sort of first saw what you're up to, I guess, in that sort of time frame, early 2019, when you started putting the spring trail clean tour together.
Yeah, well, I came back and Ben, my co-director now, he'd you know, he'd been very like incredibly patient and supportive, you know, throughout this whole process. He's like, I want to be involved, Dom. And while I was away, he realized that he really wanted it as well. So actually, sorry, I got back in December and I came back. And the first thing, I came back early because for a number of reasons, I ran out of money mostly. But also I didn't want to go, I was meant to go to India and I didn't want to just go and have a jolly. I actually wanted to come and get cracking with Trashy Trails. And I came back and we went straight to have this, what we call a Shredposium with our ambassador team. Not in North Wales at the time, in this youth hostel in the rain. But that was amazing again because these guys were fully up for it as well. And we got our vision created around that time. And the great thing is that I'd been supported by Trek, by Jez at Trek for my trip as well. So he's, and it's amazing because I was used to competition in the kind of, sadly, yeah, a bit of competition in the surf enviro world. And I expected the same thing to happen in the mountain bike world. So when I sent out these proposals asking for someone to support me, you know, one of the asks was for a bike. I got really lucky in that Jez and Rich from Kotick, you know, Kotick and Trek wanted to support me with a bike. And it was amazing. I was like, oh, wow, okay, right. And I, Rich, being basically a teenager, Rich phoned me up. I was having a haircut and Rich phoned me up. Like, and I was like, wow, he sounds so nice. Like we clicked straight away. And I kind of agreed too early, you know. I was like, yeah, amazing, because I hadn't actually spoken to Jez properly. And then I got myself in a pickle then, and I thought, no, I've spoken to Jez now. And the Jez says, I'll go and talk to Cy at Fort William about it. And I'm like, oh, no, they're going to hate me and think I'm, like, being sneaky, and I'm going to lose it, you know, completely. And they had this lovely chat, and Jez was like, look, Tom, it sounds like the guys are Kotick. The bike's perfect. I think they're better for you for this. I'll support you with kit. And I was just like, what is going on here? This is incredible. It turns out as well, like all these lovely connections. So both, I hope Jez, I don't think he, you know, he's become a wonderful friend. You know, and Jez has had his time struggling with mental health in the past. Rich is, you know, just a wonderfully sensitive man. So I know that he thinks along these lines too. So we'd really connected via that story. And so I have lost my thread a bit, but Bontrager, Trek, came back. where did I start on this run? But Ben was also lifelong friends with Jez. So they'd been talking about possibility while I was away as well. So it all converged in like December 19, where Jez is like, look, send us a proposal for the project you want to run. And I think we've got some money for you. And it's like, oh my God. So December 19th, still knackered. I'm sitting at Ben's house in Hawkesbury Upton in Gloucestershire, and we send our first proposal out. You know, and I've done these at SAS where that proposal's never leaving the door straight from my email account, put it that way, you know. So it's a really big moment. And thanks to just being an incredible person and friend and, you know, and seeing the value in us and taking a risk on us. Like, you know, he was the first person to take a risk on us, stick his neck out for us. You know, he went to his boss and said, look, I believe in this. Give it a shot. We were able to run our first professionally delivered project, the Spring Trail Clean Tour, in Easter 2019. And we did the first 9 events and then we went to Tweedlove later on. But those first 9 events, almost 300 people, something like 500 kilograms of litter. Amongst that was nearly 1,000 dog poo bags full of dog poo. We realized that beach cleans are far cleaner than trail cleans. But again, like, what a sign of appetite for what we're trying to do, that you managed to get people to come to donate their most precious thing, which I believe really is why I'm so proud, why I'm always so careful with people's volunteer time. They're donating their most precious thing to you, their Saturday or their Sunday with their family. They're giving that to you. So you've really got to take care of that and you've got to respect that. They're donating that time. And not only are they doing that, I've somehow convinced them to spend that time picking up dog poo bags. It's like, you're sitting there going, shit, we've got something here, you know? and then again, that was just, you get these lovely big like milestone moments, you know, people liked us and they had an idea of what we were trying to achieve off the back of that. But the momentum that gave us and the belief in ourselves and the bonding as a team, you know, me, Ben and Ellie, who's a designer, who's, well, she's not gone now. She's still one of our great friends, but she's definitely more of an ocean. She actually runs the ocean school education sessions for Surfers Against Sewage online now.
Okay.
She's incredible. Yeah, just that bonding and the fact that we'd recruited some new ambassadors then, you know, in Dalby Forest and Grisdale Forest and Scotland. And it was like, right, we've really got something here. But an old problem hit then, in that I was exhausted. I'd used my annual leave from Surfers Against Sewage to go and do this. And I was essentially doing the same work that I was doing at Surfers Against Sewage as well. So you kind of, it's not like you're doing different work, you know, you're doing two jobs, the same jobs. So it came back pretty tired, but also I had to then drop everything, not capitalize on all the gains we'd made because I had a project to deliver for Surfers Against Sewage. And just started to realize then that, you know, some other stuff happened around that time that was made things very difficult. So again, we had a bit of a plateau, you know, like you look at our social media, it kind of plateaued around that time because Ben and I had to go back to earning money in our jobs. And for me personally, I had to go back to paying back the respect and trust that Surfers Against Sewage had given me for 10 years. You know, I don't want to let them down. So throughout that summer, but they just got to a point like October last year, November, it's like, I am not doing either of these things justice now. I'm neither performing as well as I should be for Surfers Against Sewage, nor am I doing Trash Free Trails, the potential for Trash Free Trails justice. So I either hand it over or I go for it, you know, now or never. here I am.
So you went all in?
All in, November, yeah. And here we are.
How do you make a leap like that then? Because Trash Free Trails, it's not a money-making thing, certainly not at that point. Like, how do you get set up to the point where you can say, right, I'm going to go full-time on this?
You don't, I don't think. No, well, okay. I say you don't. I don't.
Yeah.
Because again, it doesn't seem that I work that way. But it's honest, it's going to sound cheesy probably, and hopefully I can... people believe, you know, can believe in what I'm saying, but I honestly, the term I had in my head while I was away, it happened a lot. It happened both out on the hill in the mountains or whatever, you know, riding or on a tricky section or a physically difficult section but also with shit visa problems. I need to change everything and go to Hong Kong and get my Chinese visa. I started saying to myself, gun it, because hesitation is only going to make things worse. Like, you kind of know that this is going to happen. You're going to do it. So by hesitating, you lose the impetus. So it was that really. It was like your heart, you know what your heart wants to do, Dom. Like, and you know that a successful age in life, as in, you know, have had a bloody good innings and lying on deathbed, you know that you're going to be proud of yourself for doing this.
Yeah.
And that was it, really. That was it.
Fair play. Good on you. So what's the response been like then from, well, let's start off with riders for the first part.
Absolutely fantastic. Like in the UK, especially. And that's so cool, you know, right from the start as well. And one thing I imagine you do as well, I love about the mountain bike community is that it's really, well, okay, let's obviously take into account the current things that are taking place, you know, with regard to Black Lives Matter and BMAE and things. There's obviously things that need to be looked at there and addressed, you know. But when it comes to diversity of social diversity in terms of, like, let's just go for a class system or whatever, you know, hierarchy, I find mountain biking to be an incredibly diverse from that point of view, you know, especially from surfing or whatever. And I love it because that's my background. I don't know, I've been told before I've got this posh voice, but I promise you I'm like from a work, super working class family and grew up in Wales, but just dad had this like posh voice that I seem to have picked up. My best mates in the world are plumbers, builders, you know, feisty buggers, but I've also got you know, I'm just really proud of my friends and how different they are. And that's the same with mountain biking. You've got these rum buggers, you know, from Manchester, from South Wales, who, you know, you don't want to push their buttons too much because you might find yourself on the floor, you know, like you might have deserved it as well. And you've got people who, you know, my best friend whose house I'm in now, she's a interventional radiologist, is an incredibly talented surgeon with needles and comes from Bedfordshire. You know, I love it. I love that, you know, and that's reflected in our volunteer network. And that's really, really important because the litter issue is a total social issue, you know, all society, it needs to be addressed at that level. And we are starting to move now, hopefully after lots of rabbiting and storytelling and doom and gloom, moving into, you know, what looking forward as Trashy Trails, like what we intend to do, what we are actually going to do and what we're going to actually ask people to do. And the first thing is, right, let's stop with the shock and outrage. Of course, we're shocked and outraged about what the scenes that we saw on Bournemouth Beach last week. Of course, we're shocked and outraged about the fact that someone actually pooed in a McDonald's container and left it on the beach. You know, goes without saying, but I ask, a challenge everyone listening to say, since Keep America Beautiful formed as part of an industry quango, but we won't go into that, in 1952, and started saying, calling people litter bugs, started saying, keep America, keep Britain tidy, have things improved? And I'd argue they haven't. So I'll let people just reflect on that themselves. So in other words, calling people litter bugs, scumbags, being outraged, it hasn't made any difference. It hasn't helped. And if I'm imagining that everyone who's shocked and outraged is shocked and outraged because they love those places and they would like to see them ecologically healthy. Our responsibility, our duty is to stop, put down the pitchforks and go, what do we need to do to change this? How do we do it? And the very first thing you need to do, like without fail, is to analyze the language we're using, the language of litter, and to find a way of connecting with the people who are littering, not saying to them, I can't believe how they think it's acceptable. They might not even be thinking at all. We don't know where these people are coming from. We don't know. In some inner cities, there's so much litter that it's completely normal to them to be surrounded by snowdrifts of plastic pollution. When have we tried to connect that and connect them to what we see in the outdoors? You know, yes, I'm angry, but it's completely fruitless in my opinion, you know? So that's the very bedrock of where Trash Free Trails starts from. And from that, we then go to everyone involved. We don't deal in blame or shame or guilt. You know, if you're able to do something, wonderful. We're so thankful. Don't think you have to do everything. So when we hope people believe that and they see, you know, if they believe in what we're trying to achieve enough to donate their passion to us, then they're on that journey with us. Then we've got this set of projects that we'd like them to get involved with, and a way of doing things and a way of talking that we hope might engage with different people differently, you know, and we've already seen evidence of our approach, you know. I'll share it with him because they call him, well, I don't know, I started calling him, I'm not sure how, thankfully, El Presidente, but his name's Leon Rosser. He's from South Wales, Risker area, I think, and down there, like real good downhiller, successful in the kind of, you know, Welsh national race scene. And he popped up during a recent self-isolation project we ran, and he was nominating his mates in the valleys there to go out and do a litter pick, a bit like this nomination stuff. And you could see that his community just engaged with it immediately. And it was fantastic. I was like, that's so cool. And then the first thing was like, right, okay, really important moment for us as an organization there, having learned about some of the pitfalls of being seen to take over people's community efforts. The first thing I always want us to do is ask if we can be invited. So in other words, say, you know, I went to Leon, said, look, I love what you're doing. Is it okay if we share this? You know, if not, don't worry. And he was like, yeah, no worries. And he was like, thank you for asking. Really cool. So we shared it and people really liked it. And by the end, so that was around like early April, by the end of May, I think perhaps somewhere in the region of 10 to 15 members of his community or that community from ages 15 up to 50 had done their own trail cleans and had posted about it.
Yeah.
And this is in like an area of, you know, this is not a rich middle-class area where they've, where, you know, mummies and daddies are driving around in Range Rovers talking about how they don't use straws anymore. This is an area where people haven't got much time, haven't got much money because they're trying to look after their families. I'm not judging anyone. I'm just saying this is an area that I still sound like I'm judging everyone. Sorry. That was definitely a judgmental thing to say. What I mean is it's from an organizational point of view. there we go. Everyone turns off. Is it from a conservation volunteering point of view, those people are really hard to access because they haven't got time to listen to you. They haven't got time to think about what they're trying to say because they're trying to survive, you know? So it's incredible. And that group is now fully engaged. And there's a group of guys that put this film out called the SSLB from Risca, and they made their own film. It's 9 minutes. It's on Pinkbike last week. And it is amazing. It's like these young guys talking in their voice, super funny about litter. And again, we can't do that. I'm 41 years old. I can't communicate that way. So we need, our job is to act as like a bat sign in the sky. It's not to try and own everything, not to try and imprint our voice and everything. So, yeah. Sorry, there, off again.
No, it's great. So, yeah, so what, where do we go from here then? What's next for Trash Free Trails? And what message do you want to get out to our listeners? How do you want to talk to them? What would you like them to do?
There's a couple of themes to it, really. Is the first one is, it might seem strange, really, is that to go back to our selfless isolation project, the first thing we're asking people to do, and the most important, well, the second most important thing was we're asking people just to go out on their bikes with their trail running shoes, with their kids, with their dog, onto a piece of trail or something similar that's important to them, you know, that supports them. So, for example, recently we've only been able to exercise on the nature that we could access from our front door. It became utterly vital, you know. So to go and notice that. And what I mean by that is something as well. We've kind of done people a bit of a disservice in the conservation world the last 10 years is we focused entirely, almost entirely, on the problem. So we've just hammered people and overwhelmed ourselves with the problem. And we haven't done as much work on why we care, what's our why, and connecting people to these places so we understand the compulsion to protect them. So that's the first thing I'd do is I'd ask everyone to go, you know what, today having listened to this or having seen Trash Free Trails' website, I'm just going to use my daily exercise or my weekend ride to go and just think a bit differently and notice things, notice which direction the wind's coming from. Stop and have a bit of mindfulness now by a river. Notice that that plastic bottle's been there for a while and you might pick it up one day, you know, but don't have to take any action. Just get that baseline for yourself. And then the other one was, well, I'll come to it right at the end, actually, but there is another one. So that's the notice part of it. And the final part of that self-isolation was a thing we call reward. But I'll get to that after I get to the technical side of things. So that's the stuff. And then you might have noticed I said they're a baseline. So anyone listening who's scientifically minded, or I, you know, just I'm sure lots of people who listen will have noticed something, is that when we say, they might be saying to me, well, how on earth are you gonna tell or measure that you've reduced litter on trails by 75% by 2025? And like, it's the big thing everyone asks, and I promise you it's not I'm not lying now, it is a trap I've set because I learned it at Surfers Against Sewage. We did it there. I said we're going to do a 50% reduction. Well, actually, in 2012, Surfers Against Sewage said they're going to have a 50% reduction in marine litter by 2020. So, yeah. so we believe we have more of a chance of that. There's a few reasons. Firstly, there's no tides on the forest. You know, we are the tide. So that's the first thing. It's totally possible because all we've got to do is it's a behavior change of the people who use those places. But to come back to the 75%, yes. Right now, there's no way we could do that. So our first task is to establish, understand the sources, causes, impacts, you know, prevalence and impacts of litter, most notably plastic pollution, on our trails and wild places. To give a bit of background, the scientific consensus now is that there's a pressing need for far more understanding of the impacts of plastic on terrestrial ecosystems. There's almost a literal zero science, and you compare that to to the impact of plastics on oceans or marine ecosystems, it's just a massive disparity. And again, put that in perspective, there's 4 to 20, they estimate 4 to 23 times more. So you can see how much science needs to be done, because 4 to 23 is quite a broad range. But 4 to 23 times more plastic escapes into terrestrial ecosystems than it does into the ocean every year. Wow. And they estimate that 13 million tons of plastic pollution escapes into the oceans every year. 23 times 13 million tons.
Wow.
Yeah, and we know the stats about dolphins, or the fact that each year you might eat 11,000 pieces of plastic if you eat seafood, you know, like the fact that that some of these plastics act as magnets to organic pollutants, persistent organic pollutants that are shown to act as gender benders that are changing the sex of animal of fish. You know, it's like, oh my God, you know, and this stuff is
scary stuff.
Yeah. So there's that. So firstly, we need to go just to retract a little bit, because remember the guilt thing, we're small, we're tiny, you know, the mountain bike community is small in comparison to other, you know, so let's just do our bit in the ecosystem. Let's just play our role in what we hope could be a healthy conservation ecosystem. So let's focus on our patch, the things that we're passionate about, you know, use that. So we, made in our minds right early on at Trash of Trails, the most important project is what we're now calling the State of Our Trails Report. So it is that understanding of those things I listed, the impacts of plastic pollution on our trails. So the reason that Chris, you know, you guys so kindly have chosen to speak to us and put the podcast out on today, which today you're hearing, I hope, the 14th of July, is that we're really proud to begin the State of Our Trails Report project. It's a 5-year academic research project. We're working with Bangor University on it. She's just incredible. We're actually working with a chap called Dr. Martin Kerr. He's the lead supervisor, who was the lead author of the plastic particles in our washing report that was very well read a couple of years ago. So we've got an amazing team, and we're launching today, and we're beginning the State of the Trails Report baseline study. And again, massively important partnership on that for a number of reasons. Firstly, they're supporting us financially, but secondly, they're a big player in the mountain bike industry, is that Bosch and Bosch e-bike systems are partnering with us on that baseline study, which we're beginning today on the 14th. So all of that working all the way up to November 2022, where we will release the State of Our Trails Report. So by then we'll understand the state of our trails. You know, we will have taken loads of action to remove litter, but right then we get an understanding, and we'll also have used this scientific evidence to design a series of projects that have maximum impact and create sustainable change. And we will then use the next 2 years, so 23, 24, 25, to implement those projects with our community. And hopefully by 2025, we will then do our surveys, and we'll find that at least on 5 trails around the country, we've got to start sensibly. Apparently I've been told off, that's not scientific. We'll have demonstrated a significant reduction in plastic pollution on trails and wild places that we're studying. And even more importantly, I believe, we'll have also demonstrated an increase in nature connection and feelings of environmental stewardship amongst the people who engage with the project, which is vital if it's to be a sustainable change. So that is the State of Our Trails Report. And 5-year project, really exciting. And the way we, again, if people can visualize, the way I visualize it, and we've got an amazing designer working on a infographic of all these things that we'll share on the 14th as well, that those of you who work visually hope will help with that, is that we've got, we refer to the state of our trails report as our hub project. So it is fed by and feeds all of our other sub projects for the next 5 years. And that's fantastic because it adds a sense of at least double purpose, perhaps even triple purpose, to every action we ask people to take. So if you ask that youngster to come and join you at the Forest of Dean to do a trail clean on Sunday when all they want to do is just ride downhill, those bottles that they pick up, they haven't just made a direct difference to the ecological state and the visible appearance of that trail and remove plastic pollution. They have also given vital data into the State of the Trails report on their, you know, being the fact that they're young, and it's important that we show that they're happy to donate their time. The brand of that bottle, the number of bottles they found, the state of degradation, where it was found, all of this will feed into the State of Our Trails report, and we'll put together, you know, the first ever and most comprehensive paper on the state of our trails and what we need to do to protect them. We've seen, which is, mm-hmm. yeah, which is for us, we don't want to exist forever. We want to create self-sustaining communities who, you know, who are positive stewards of their own trails and wild places. And we believe this.
Yeah, and hopefully everyone listening to this will understand that and appreciate the need to get out there and do something and keep the trails that we need. It's as simple as that. We need them, and keeping them clean is the least we can do, really.
Yeah, it's like this podcast doesn't exist without the trails and the environments that host them. You know, like Santa Cruz Trek, Bosch, e-bike systems, you know, trash-free trails, we don't exist without them. So they're the first name on the team sheet. They have to be. If you're an event organizer, it has to be the first name. How do we not harm, actually, firstly, not harm at the very least, ideally enhance the environment we're going into use, you know, that we're essentially treating like a product. It's vital. I don't mean that in a negative way, you know, just it's possible. So just have that in your mind, you know, and then, like I say, you know, you've asked how people can get involved. You know, it's COVID. We've managed to get all the way through like COVID, but COVID has hit our plan for the year. You know, we right now we were hoping to be celebrating and we're going through the rushes. I'm saying words that I don't really understand, but you know, editing a film that we wanted to film with Marky Matthews from British Columbia and Hannah Barnes about a purposeful adventure during the solstice week. You know, for example, we would have got rained on actually, but which is the thing, you know, we were meant to be preparing, we were meant to be having our Trash Free Trails approved race scheme running right now, you know, but no races are running. I was meant to be living in Scotland for 2 months, you know, after doing Fort Bill and riding the Highland Trail. So we've adapted our plans, but We have developed a 5-year strategy of projects. Again, the artwork will be hopefully going alongside this on the 14th. So you can see we're having it created like a Strava profile. So you can kind of see when things are happening and how the impact ratchets up like an increasingly hard climb. But, you know, I would love it if people followed us on Instagram and our social media at Trash Free Trails, jumped on our website, you know, and checked our news every now and then and checked our projects, you know, got in contact and told us what they'd like to do. You know, our next big project that we've got our fingers for being possible is what we call the Autumn Litter Watch. So it's kind of spring, BBC Spring Watch style weekend where we live cast out, but we ask people, we provide a toolkit for people to take part from where they are. And the idea behind the main idea for the state of our trails report behind that will be what we call hashtag brand spotting. So we're going to be, we're going to be asking people to, one of the main aims is to find out, you know, what brands are the primary brands of litter that they're finding on their trails and wherever their trails are. So that's the big one. We off the back of this, Autumn Litter Watch will be happening in some form, and we would love people to be involved with it. And I probably should shut up. And like I say, we are a community organization. We're powered by people seeing the value in what we're trying to achieve and donating their time to them. We're so incredibly grateful. And if you donate that time to us, we promise we'll try our very best to respect your donation. And thanks to you, Chris, for this, and thanks to Jez especially, but Trek Bikes, and most importantly, our partners for the State of Our Trails report baseline study, Bosch e-bike systems, and again, Chris at Bosch. Thank you very much.
Cool. Thank you, man. It's super, super good to chat. And it's a very, very worthy cause that hopefully a lot of the listeners can get involved in. So just where are they going? Can you give us the social media handle and the website address, and then I can put those in the show notes as well?
Yeah, so all of our social media is at Trash Free Trails. That's Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. We're most active on Instagram because we like pictures. And our website is www.trashfreetrails.org. If they want to email us, mine email is dom@trashfreetrails.org. Please do email and say, I want to get more involved. People's talents, there's so much talent out there. For example, you, Chris, you're making a podcast that I couldn't make a podcast. So we want people to feel that they're part of our ecosystem. And Ben's like an industry expert developing some really cool products that we're excited to announce about soon. And he's ben@trashfreetrails.org. I won't give my phone number.
That's okay. But yeah, I know a lot of people from the brands listen, and some of the race organizers listen as well. So yeah, if any of them are interested in getting involved, I guess emailing one of you guys is the best place to head.
The race organizers, please, if you're listening, we've got a scheme that we wanted to pilot this year, but we haven't been able to, called Trash Free Trails Approved. And it is like a self-assessment process. It's been developed by a guy, he's a guy who from Bude Department 26 Mountain Bike Club, but serious operator. And what he's created for us is insane. It's so, so good. So please, if you want to pilot that in any way, just have a look at it and give us your feedback on it. Whether it would work for you, please get in touch, because we'd love to test that. Again, we think it could enhance your events. We're creating it with that mindset, not a "you've got to do this, we're going to wag our finger at you" mindset. So yeah, please get in touch.
Cool. All right. Well, yeah, it's been very interesting finding out a bit more about you personally, and also about Trash Free Trails and how people can get involved. So yeah, we'll put all the links to social media and to the website in the show notes for this episode over on the website, so people can find that. Yeah, wish you all the best, and hopefully see you at a trail clean at some point in the future when COVID allows.
Yeah, we'll be back.
Cool. Nice one. Cheers, Dom.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks very much.
Right, that's it for this episode with Dom. I hope you've enjoyed listening, and I really hope it makes you think about the impact that we all have on our outdoor spaces. And it would be great if you headed over to trashfreetrails.org to find out more about how you can get involved. A massive thanks to Nukeproof and Layout for supporting this episode. This podcast would no longer exist without the support of the awesome brands and listeners who help me keep this thing going. Don't forget to head to nukeproof.com and check out their entire range. If you want to be in with a chance of winning a set of their new Horizon wheels, then you just need to head to downtimepodcast.com/nukeproof and answer the really easy question. It even tells you where to go and find the answer. Also, head over to layout.com and check out their awesome range of products. And if you want to be in with a chance of winning a pair of their new Aaron Chase signature shoes, then head to layout.com/ACshoe. That's layout spelled LEAATT.com/ACshoe, and get entered before the end of July. All the links are in the show notes for this episode over on downtimepodcast.com. Don't forget to check out all the new t-shirts over at downtimepodcast.com/shop, where you can pick yourself up some new threads and help support the podcast at the same time. Leaving a review of the show wherever you listen is really great for helping new people find the podcast. So if you've got a couple of minutes, then it'd be really great if you could leave us a review there. Please make sure that you're subscribed to the show so you don't miss an episode. And please, please keep spreading the word amongst your riding mates. The more people that listen, the easier it is for me to keep this thing going and to keep bringing you an episode every week. All right, we've got another awesome episode coming up soon, but until then, look after each other, and if it's okay to do so, then get out and ride.